name's Joan Hunt. I'm a campus pastor in Portland, Oregon. And I am looking today with you at the covenant that God made with King David and his dynasty, his descendants, his house. There are a number of covenants that God makes with people in the Old Testament, and I'm going to review the other covenants just briefly. The first covenant that we have in the Old Testament is with Noah and his family and all living creatures and every animal. They're named as partners in the covenant with God. And God's covenant with this whole creation then, I assume if this had been recorded in this day and age, it would probably say, and with the whole planet. That covenant is unconditional on the part of God. God says, I'm never going to pull off anything like the flood again. I'm going to preserve day and night and the course of the seasons and the order of creation. So you don't have to worry about that. That's out of the question that anything is going to happen on my part to tamper with or to change those things. So in that covenant, or that relationship that God sets up with creation, God is the one who's obliged to do something, and creation is just the glad recipient of God's promises or of God's commitment to live that way. The next covenant that we come up to is the covenant with Abraham and the descendants that he has with his wife Sarah. And that is a promise that Abraham's name will be great, that Abraham will be blessed to be a blessing to the nations of the earth, that they will have a place to live, that there will be many descendants. So it's a promise of land and of continuity through the generations. What's Abraham's part in that promise or that covenant?
To wait.
Abraham just has to receive what God is going to do. So again, this is a unconditional promise that God makes, and God is the one who's bound to carry out the covenant. Now, covenant is a relationship established between two parties, at least, where there is a solemn promise to carry out the agreement. The covenant is based on a history that the parties have with each other, so there's already some commonality established, and it says, based on what's already happened between us, these are the expectations from here on out. And in the ancient Near East, generally, there was a stronger party who would name the terms of the covenant, and the other party would be in a more inferior position and would say, okay, I agree, and would be the one taking the obligation on themselves. It was a solemn obligation, a promise that was made usually with some fearsome symbols connected with it. Symbols like sacrificing an animal, which meant, if I don't keep this covenant, may I be treated the same way as this animal I've just slaughtered and split. Or blood poured on all the parties of the covenant, which means now we share the same life. Now, our blood is the same blood, even though we're not related by blood, but our destiny is tied up together inseparably. Or sharing a meal, which means now we're friends because we don't eat with enemies, but now we have this solemn bond of hospitality between us, and we shall treat each other when we meet each other in the future, in all our dealings in the future, we shall treat each other with hospitality and kindness that we have, as we have exhibited here in this meal together. And so in the two covenants we just looked at, Noah and Abraham, God is the one who is bound to the covenant. It's an unconditional kind of covenant. It's a covenant we might call a regardless covenant. That's not quite the right word, is it? It doesn't sound right. An unconditional covenant would be another way of saying it. And Abraham and his descendants, or the whole creation, just need to be the happy recipients of the promise that God has bound God's own self to. And then there's the third covenant that comes up, the covenant at Sinai, that God makes with all of Israel through Moses. It's different. It's kind of like the first covenant in the sense that it's with a large group of people, but not quite as large a group as all of creation. And it's kind of like the covenant with Abraham in that all of these people are judged to be descendants of Abraham or connected with Abraham in some kind of historical tradition. But it's a different kind of covenant because God is acting as the sovereign and saying, because of our history together, because I brought you out of Egypt and redeemed you from slavery, this is how I expect you to act. Now the Ten Commandments are given, part of which concern the people's relationship with God, and part of which concern the people's relationship with one another and with the strangers in their midst, or with whoever might join the community in the future. And so, in this case, who is obligated in terms of the covenant? Not God, but the people. Or we might say God has some obligation. God's going to be consistent with what God has already shown, being a saving and redeeming and liberating God. But it's the people who are now answering with their response to this graciousness of God by living in loyalty and fidelity to God and in consideration and care for one another. And so this could be called an if type of covenant. If you do this and this and this and this, then the covenant is continuing and in force. If you do not, the covenant is broken. And it will be appropriate for the sovereign to take certain steps to reinstate the covenant, because after all, you made a solemn agreement that you were going to keep it. So if you break it, then the solemn steps will be what? To send prophets to remind you, to call you back, and so on and so on. And Deuteronomy 28 has, in fact, a number of curses that are described if the covenant's broken. Most of them are just the effects of what will happen in society if things like the Ten Commandments are not observed. If we don't speak truth with one another, we're going to be in a messy situation of lies. If we don't respect one another's property and possessions and business, then we're going to be in a state where many of us are poor and exploited, and others of us have great privilege and lord it over one another. So think with me for a minute about what would society look like if we kind of lived within the ballpark rules of the Ten Commandments. What would society be like? Wonderful.
Like the Garden of Eden.
Like the Garden of Eden. Can you think of some specifics? What might be different from the way it is now? Or what might be true if you ever have lived in a community where...
No locks, no fences, no guard dogs.
No broken families, not the broken families.
Mm-hmm. Not broken families, not fences, locks, and guard dogs.
No hungry people.
No hungry people. Immigrants and aliens would be treated as privileged members of the community.
Churches would be full.
Churches would be full.
They'd be overflowing.
God would be praised.
The kind of technology that we seem to worship would not be as prevalent. We'd probably be living a lot more primitive lifestyle.
You think a more primitive lifestyle?
Compared to
technologically, you're saying we might not have run away with technology for its own sake.
Right.
We wouldn't look to it for salvation.
We wouldn't look to technology for salvation. And it seems to me that even though we might have advanced technology, we would make darn sure that we weren't using it to bomb villages, but rather to weatherize all of our buildings or something like that.
It never really says that there won't be commissions against these Ten Commandments. These Ten Commandments say if you don't obey, this is what's going to happen.
But right.
Always at that point, they realized that these bad things were going to happen.
Yeah, the human factor is there, and it's never envisioned
so never
that the commandments are going to be pure. Garden of Eden is not now.
We never would have that covenant.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is exactly the tension that's going to be raised in the next covenant that we're going to look at today. The tension between the unconditional promise of God and the wonderful vision that God gives and the human reality that we fall short and that our motives are mixed and that things never quite work out in the fullness. Yet we hope for the fullness and work for the fullness and repent and convert and start over again. That is all contained in the covenant that God makes with King David. Now we've got a situation where The people have been living together in as a loose confederation of tribes. So in their own family groupings, but the family groupings have connections with other family groupings in these 12 tribes. And if something comes up and they need a decision made about a hard case of law, you know, what should we do in a case like this? Well, they take it to people who have some expertise and wisdom who come to be called judges. Or if a battle needs to be fought because some people are impinging from the outside, they'll get together for the time being and fight a battle, also under the leadership of these judges. So it's a very functional kind of leadership that they've had with the judges, and it kind of rises and falls as it needs to be in place. Samuel is a great judge, and we're going to look at the end of his career in 1 Samuel chapter 8. I think most everyone here has the RSV translation. I have the New Revised Standard Version, and mine might be slightly different from yours. So I'm going to have you read this text. I'd like this side over here to read the narrator's part, this middle section to be the elders of Israel. I'll be Samuel, and you all over here can be the voice of the Lord speaking to Samuel. And so anytime the narrator is in, you people be the narrator. We are going to read verses 1 through 9 right now. First Samuel 8. First Samuel 8, verses 1 to 9. The narrators may please begin.
When Samuel became old, he made his sons judges over Israel. The name of his firstborn son was Joel, and the name of the second, Abijah. They were judges in Beersheba. Yet his sons did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after gain. They took bribes and perverted justice. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, "Behold, you are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint for us a king to govern us like all the nations." But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to govern us." And Samuel prayed to the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel,
"Hearken to the voice of the people and all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. According to all the deeds which they have done to me, from the day I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so they are also doing to you. Now then, hearken to their voice. Only you shall solemnly warn them and show them the ways of the king who shall reign over them."
We note so far that God is clearly saying that God is the king over Israel, and this looks like an ominous move to God, that the people want a king. But you can understand their feelings. They had lousy judges. What were they going to do? Everyone else had a king, seemed to be working for them. They wanted a king. But Samuel now is going to warn them of the dangers of having a king. And I'll be the voice of Samuel in this next section, 10 to 18. And you see what you think of Samuel's description of a king. Samuel, someone who's represented and kept alive the tradition of the covenant among the people, and reminded them of what they promised at Sinai and what God promised to them in this kind of democratic, even-handed, functional sort of way of living together. So Samuel says,
"So Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people
who were asking a king from him.
He said,
'These will be the ways of the king who will reign over you. He'll take your sons and appoint them to his chariots and to be his horsemen and to run before his chariots. And he will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and some to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and to make his implements of war and the equipment of his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive orchards and give them to his courtiers. He'll take one-tenth of your grain and of your vineyards and give it to his officers and his courtiers. He'll take your male and female slaves and the best of your cattle and donkeys and put them to his work. He will take one-tenth of your flocks, and you shall be his slaves. And in that day you will cry out because of your king, whom you've chosen for yourselves, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. The covenant was based on, we cried and the Lord answered. Samuel is saying, this whole kingship business will be on a different basis, and you will cry and the Lord will not answer. And what kind of government is Samuel saying is the possible threat of having a king?
Oppressive.
Yeah, oppressive, exploitive government. One where the king does not exist for the sake of the people, but the people exist for the sake of the hierarchy, the bureaucracy. And the best goes to the king. Well, people decide they want to go ahead with it anyhow, and God decides to go with it. But they kept alive this memory of the other tradition and of what they really thought a king should stand for and should do. I'd like you to look at Psalm 72 right now, which I call the job description for the king of Israel.
You know, if Samuel was so concerned about those things, how come he didn't teach his sons that way?
Well, that is an interesting question. If he'd done better with his children, they wouldn't have needed a king, huh? Yeah. Psalm 72 is a prayer that God will give the king God's own justice, which is kind of a way of saying, you know, there'd be another way of being king besides this way that Samuel just described. There'd be a way of being the king where the king could act really like in God's interests on earth. The king wouldn't have to be absolutist and at the top of the heap, but the king could be God's justice, be the agent of God's justice in our midst, and the agent of God's righteousness. Righteousness and justice are two closely related Old Testament terms. Roughly what they mean is to satisfy the needs in a relationship. If you're righteous, you are living in community with people and meeting the needs of the community so that your own good is not paramount to you, but the goods of everyone is paramount to you, and you're working together that there can be wholeness, that there can be shalom or peace for the whole community. So this is the prayer, that we have that kind of king who accomplishes, who exhibits justice and righteousness. And then there's some examples of what it would mean to have a righteous and just king. Is this a carpenter?
Mm-hmm.
Would someone please ask the carpenter to hold off till 10 o'clock here so that this doesn't bother us through this session? Thank you. First I thought, I don't know what I thought, was a bird or something. Took me a while to notice what was going on there.
A big bird?
It was the bear.
Right. Let me in, let me in.
Samuel knocking.
How would we know if we had a righteous and just king? Well, verse 2, 3, and 4. He would judge the people with righteousness. They'd get a fair deal. He'd judge the poor with justice. So the poor in particular would be singled out as people who needed special protection and consideration. The mountains would yield prosperity, not just for the king and his courtiers. The mountains would yield prosperity for the people. So would the hills in righteousness. And the king would defend the cause of the poor of the people, give deliverance to the needy, and crush the oppressor. Protect the people, give them a place of safety. And that's reiterated again in verses 12 through 14, delivering the needy when they call, the poor and those who have no helper. Have pity on the weak and the needy. Save the lives of the needy. From oppression and violence, he redeems their life, the king does, and precious is their blood in his sight. Really matters to this kind of king what's happening in the land as a whole, and particularly to the needy who need the king to look out for them, who need the government to be on their side. If this were a job description for the American government, would United States look like it does now?
But we do not have a king. We are the king.
We think.
We think. I think it's still a live tension in our society. We have a vision of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for all, and equal protection under the law. And we also have a society that functions with the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer. And so there's a gap between our commitments, constitutionally and legally, and our practice, legally and in actuality.
Now you think the forefathers of the Constitution and all have that, had this sort of thing in mind, but the actuality does not. It's sometimes falling short.
Mm-hmm. The same thing happened in Israel. In spite of this job description for a king, did all the kings do it? So the history of the Old Testament, once you get to a certain point, is really a report card rating for king after king after king and how they did, and whether they used their position to their own aggrandizement or whether they used their position for the good of the needy and the poor and the oppressed. Of course, it wasn't always easy to tell either. It's really a judgment call, and you may believe that you're operating for the good of the whole society, and hindsight will show that, in fact, that didn't turn out to be true, or a few people benefited, but others were exploited and hurt. One thing that I discover when I think about this covenant that God makes with David that we're going to look at in a minute is that there's no such thing as a pure realm. There's no such thing as a pure king. There's no such thing as a pure government. This covenant that God makes with David almost sounds like a blank check, giving David any kind of power or any kind of continuity that David needs or wants. It's a wonderful statement of God's graciousness to David. It says, you're going to have a dynasty, your people are going to have a place to live, I'll give you safety from your enemies, you're going to have a great name. I promise it, and it will be true forever and ever and ever. And somehow that gracious promise of God just lies at the cusp of God's graciousness, but the possibility or the danger of David's taking advantage of God's good promise. And so if David takes it that direction and takes advantage of the promise that God has given, then this promise turns out to be ideology, propaganda for an unjust regime instead of a gracious covenant of God that helps something wonderful happen among people on earth. And how do you sort that out? Should God not give blank checks like that to David just because of the danger? So there's this call to kind of live at this balance point that acknowledges God's graciousness and power and creativity and commitment, but that also lives in honest obedience to the promise that God has given, or lives in the same spirit in which the covenant was given and doesn't run away with it and take advantage of it. And America, the United States, which set itself up to be the new people of Israel and to live in this Old Testament covenant and to be the light shining on the hill, lives in the same balance place.
Was this pretty much the basis of the divine right it came for about 1700 years?
Probably. I'm not familiar enough with that history and where it came from. Anybody here know?
Well, I think they got something from the Bible that the rule of the king was divine, and that according to the Bible you owe the king obedience.
Mm-hmm. Unconditionally.
Romans probably has more along that line of that concept of government having its own rights.
Yeah, Romans 13, be subject to the higher authorities.
Mm-hmm. The Holy Roman Empire.
Well, now we're going to look at the covenant that God gave to David. 2 Samuel 7. Anyone familiar with 2 Samuel 7 already? A wonderful Old Testament scholar named Walter Brueggemann, I'll put his name on the board, says that 2 Samuel 7 is the theological centerpiece of the Old Testament. So if you don't know it already, you have a treat ahead of you. Walter Brueggemann. Second Samuel 7. Here's the background to this. Samuel the prophet went ahead and anointed a king of Israel. The first king was Saul. But Saul proved to be a rather inept king. He just didn't quite get it all together. His reign wasn't very consistent. And so even while he was yet king, God instructed Samuel to anoint another king, and it would be one of the sons of Jesse. It's a very humorous story. Samuel goes to the house of Jesse and says to Jesse, "So let me see your sons." He knows that he's going to anoint one of them king. Jesse has no idea what's going on. But Jesse brings in his sons one after another, and Samuel keeps saying, "Oh, wow, this one's good looking. It must be this one." Or, "Oh, wow, this one's tall. It must be this one. He looks competent. It must be this one." And son after son after son comes through, and God doesn't say that it's any of them. And so finally Samuel says, "Well, do you have any more sons?"
More height.
And Jesse says, "Well, yeah, my youngest son, my eighth son, David, he's shepherd out in the fields." "Well, okay, well, bring me David." And it turns out David is the one. All the things that Samuel might have used to judge, he's strong, he's good looking, he looks competent, he looks like he could lead people. It's David, the shepherd, that God picks. And so David, from this obscure, it's kind of an Abe Lincoln story, you know, from log cabin to the White House. And the whole story of David is told in such a way that obviously David is a plucky, nervy, admirable character with a lot of leadership qualities. But mixed with this at the same time is the choice, the providence, the election of God. And you can't really sort out what it is that's at work at any given point. It is David and who he is, and it's Yahweh, God, and who God is, working together. And so David kind of rises through the ranks. You know the story. One of the very first things he does in public spheres is when he comes to bring some provisions to his brothers who are in the army, he realizes that they're being intimidated by this Philistine named Goliath, who's saying, "Na, na, 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 oh, you are weaklings. You don't dare stand up to me." And David's going, "But the God of the covenant is on our side. Of course we can stand up to this guy." And all the soldiers are going, "Oh, no, he's too strong and powerful." David goes out there even without any armor on. I mean, Saul says, "Hey, you can't go after this trained, experienced, huge warrior with no armor. Wear my armor." David tries it on. It's uncomfortable. He says, "So I'm not going to be able to do anything with this." Takes it off again, heads out there with nothing but himself, his confidence in Yahweh, his pluckiness, and the skill that he developed as a shepherd with a sling, and knocks out Goliath and beheads him. And that threat is ended. And that kind of surprising daring and faith and good fortune and providence follow David all through his career. He manages to make a friend of the man he's going to replace, Saul, although it's an uneasy love-hate kind of relationship from Saul's side. But he makes a covenant, David does, with Saul's son, Jonathan, so he has a steadfast friend right in the house of Saul. He marries one of Saul's daughters. He beats the Philistines in battle after battle. I mean, he just seems to be blessed. He is blessed, according to the story. For a while, though, he works on the other side. He's with the Philistines in their camp because he needs to escape from Saul's anger for a while. It's an amazing, wonderful story to read and reread. And finally, we've reached the point where Saul, city of the southern tribes and not a city of the northern tribes, but is a city that was formerly independent right in the middle, a city called Jerusalem that was owned and operated by the Jebusites. Well, David conquered Jerusalem, which sits on a hill. so that there aren't any conflicting loyalties among the people of the North or the South. You know, he chose our city. Why didn't he choose our city? He chose their city. David's figured that out. He's got Jerusalem as his capital now. And he's taken the symbol of the faith of the people, the Ark of the Covenant, the fancy box in which are carried the tablets of the Ten Commandments, that was this kind of centerpiece of their worship space through their whole history. And he's brought that to his new capital in Jerusalem. So he is sitting pretty. Only problem is, Israel's never had a king like this before. And they're going to be giving up some things to go to a royal system of government instead of this kind of federation of tribes. And so David is pretty concerned to consolidate his power. It'd be really nice, David thinks, if he could have a symbol of God's blessing on his realm or his reign. Something even beyond just having the Ark of the Covenant there. And so, the beginning of chapter 7. Now when the king was settled in his house, and the Lord had given him rest from all his enemies around him, the king said to the prophet Nathan, "See, now I'm living in a house of cedar, expensive wood that came from the hills of Lebanon far away, but the Ark of God stays in a tent." What do you think he wants to do? He wants to build a house for the Ark, which will also be a very nice symbol that God has blessed his reign and is right there to be worshipped. He kind of wants to put God in a box. Maybe I present David a little too cynically, but I think David operates out of a sincere faith. But you see, you can also be suspicious. It's right at this edge between deep faith and devotion to God and manipulative using of God's name and God's power for one's advantage. Nathan says to the king, "Go do everything you have in mind. The Lord is with you." I mean, we've seen that. He's brought you from the flocks to here. The Lord is with you. That's Nathan's first impression, but he gets a different vision that night then. That same night, the word of the Lord came to Nathan. "Go and tell my servant David, thus says the Lord, are you the one to build me a house to live in? I haven't lived in a house since the day I brought up the people of Israel from Egypt to this day. But I've been moving about in a tent and a tabernacle." What's God saying there? I'm not going to be
don't
pinned.
Fit me in.
Don't fit. Yeah. I'm not going to be pinned down. I'm not going to be turned into somebody's pet object or into someone's patron or chaplain. I'm not the patron of David. I'm the God of Israel. "Wherever I have moved about among all the people of Israel, did I ever speak a word to any of the tribal leaders of Israel whom I commanded to shepherd my people Israel, saying, 'Why haven't you built me a house of cedar?' Now therefore, thus you shall say to my servant David." So at this point in hearing this, we could be thinking that David's ready for a reprimand, you know. Who do you think you are trying to fence me in? But as a matter of fact, God is going to do even more abundantly for David than David could think or ask. He wanted to honor God, give God's name a place of centralized worship in Jerusalem, a place to keep the Ark of the Covenant. And God's saying, "I don't need that, but here's what I will do for you. Thus says the Lord of hosts, I took you from the pasture, from following the sheep, to be prince over my people Israel. And I have been with you wherever you went, and have cut off all your enemies from before you. And I will make for you a great name, like the name of the great ones of the earth. And I will appoint a place for my people Israel, and will plant them so that they may live in their own place, and be disturbed no more. And evildoers shall afflict them no more as formerly, from the time that I appointed judges over my people Israel. And I will give you rest from all your enemies." Those are already three great promises. You'll be great. The people will have a place. You all will live in safety. And then if that were not enough, then God goes on to say, "Moreover, The Lord declares to you that the Lord will make you a house. This is a pun. David was going to make a house for the Ark of the Covenant for the Lord's name, and instead the Lord's going to make David a house. Not in the sense of a building, but in the sense of a dynasty. When your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your ancestors, I will raise up your offspring after you, who shall come forth from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. You want a blank check? Forever. I will be a father to him, and he shall be a son to me. And then listen to this next. When he commits iniquity, I will punish him with a rod such as mortals use, with blows inflicted by human beings. But I will not take my steadfast love from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I put away from before you. Your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever. In accordance with all these words and with all this vision, Nathan spoke to David. So this promise is immense, and it is not only immense, but it's unconditional. It's the unconditional type. It's not even only an unconditional type, it's a nevertheless type of covenant. Even if you sin, and there will be consequences to the sin, nevertheless, God says, what I'm promising you is going to be true. So that in some ways this is like the covenant given to Abraham. God is the one who is bound, and there are no strings attached for David and his descendants. It's like the covenant that God made with Noah and all living creatures. God's going to do this. It's an everlasting covenant, and that is even not part of the covenant with Abraham, so this is a step beyond that. This is, in the first place, an amazing, clear statement of justification by grace. But there's also a danger inherent in there. What's the danger that you see? I want to test and see if this is true. You see what the limits are. What can you get away with? Yeah, so if everything is sure, then, you know, yeah, take it for granted. No big deal. I'm just going to live with it and thanks and praise I'm not due.
David rarely does that, though.
David rarely does that.
But his sons and ancestors.
Yes. They liked to live off this inheritance very well, without the sense of immediate connection to God that David seemed to have. Now David, the rest of this chapter is David's response in prayer to this covenant that God has just made with him and his children to come. First of all, David starts out kind of deferential. He's saying, oh Lord God, you know, why did I deserve this? Who am I that you should have done a thing like this? Wow. And then there's a doxology in verses 22 to 24. Nobody like you, O Lord God, nobody like you. So the whole tenor of the first part of David's response is, boy, you really shouldn't have made an offer like this. And then about halfway through, verses 25 on, David is saying, but since you did make the offer, I expect you to keep this promise. I'm going to take you up on this. This is great. I can run with this. And that's kind of David's response to God. It's nervy faith. It's really bold. I mean, he's about as bold with Yahweh as he'd been with Goliath. You know, all right, well, we can go for this. Let's see what we can do with this.
God loves it, though.
God loves it? David, yeah, a man after his own heart. Somebody who would just kind of hang in there and interact with God. I would think that would be very fun for God. And so that's what David does. So David is poised in his faith with God, just at the balance point between glad yielding and accepting what God has done and manipulating or using God. And David really is at that balance point. What happens even in David's own career is that there comes a point when David thinks he can get away with murder, quite literally. Where David thinks that he's above the law and that this promise secures him in such a way and his position as king secures him in such a way that he can do what he wants to do for himself. And so he has one of his good generals killed in battle so that the general Uriah's wife, Bathsheba, can become part of David's harem. David lives as if the law does not apply to him, as if he can disregard the covenant.
You know, there seems to be the difference between, because David and Saul both did things that were, you know, not right. Saul would, when he was confronted, would try and hide it. Say, you know, like he had all these sheep and things in the backyard. He wasn't supposed to take any of them. And remember, I think, is it Nathan that comes to him and says, you know, what do I hear out your backyard? Got all these sheep that he's taken from battle that he wasn't supposed to take, and he tries to pretend that they aren't there.
Yeah.
But David, when he's confronted, is as bold with himself as he is with everybody else.
Yes.
He admits that he...
And he repents, and he's called back to that covenantal reality, to the fact that he stands in relationship with God, and that a promise, a living bond of covenant, a relationship is between them. And that is David's characteristic. But I think it was clear to Israel that this was a dangerous blank check, and that if David could make mistakes, although then David would come back to the point of repentance and conversion, you know, what would happen in later generations? Would everyone be as amazing as David? And so so two things happened as a result of this unconditional, or there are kind of two strands of developing tradition as a result of this unconditional covenant that God gives to David. One of them, already by David's deathbed, will you look at 1 Kings 2? 1 Kings 2, verse 4. David's time to die is drawing near, and so he's talking to his son Solomon, who will be king after him. Well, in fact, we could read this whole section very well. I'm about to go the way of all the earth. Be strong, be courageous, and keep the charge of the Lord your God, walking in his ways and keeping his statutes, his commandments, his ordinances, and his testimonies, as it is written in the law of Moses, so that you may prosper in all that you do and wherever you turn. Then the Lord will establish his word that he spoke concerning me. If your heirs take heed to their way to walk before me in faithfulness with all their heart and with all their soul, there shall not fail you a successor on the throne of Israel. This is very different than what David heard from God.
I sort of think we do that all the time. You know, sort of what we receive, we're not so generous in giving to the next group of people.
That's right. And it also shows up in some of the Psalms that this unconditional, nevertheless type of covenant is transmogrified into an if you do this and this and this, then you will be blessed covenant. So one thing that happens to this blank check David was given is that it's conditioned later in the tradition, and they're starting to say, you know, we don't want any kings who run away with their power and take, 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 take. And we need to remind you that the kingship in Israel is for the sake of the good of the whole community. So if you remember that, then you deserve these promises of God.
Well, Joan, did God change too? Because there are times later with the kings where they worship other gods and God sort of takes his blessing from them.
Mm-hmm.
So did God change the covenant too? I kind of wondered about that. But...
Interesting question.
Well, David is talking here as though he understood this to be a condition of it. So he's not doing this for his own benefit.
No. He's doing it for whose benefit?
God's benefit.
For God's benefit. For the dynasty's benefit, so
which
that
is,
his children can continue.
Which is his benefit, because that was the way you, that was salvation for you, is the, how you were remembered in the future in your ancestors. So it may have been for David's benefit as well.
Isn't this just another way of putting a hedge around the law? I mean, it's just sort of like, well, I know that you're gonna make mistakes, and so therefore I'm gonna try and keep you from making those mistakes by forbidding you to get close to falling over the edge. And I think that we just do that all the time. We do it right here at Holden.
Example?
So, well, one more rule, you know, one more rule about where you can go and where you can't go and what time you do this and what time, instead of, I mean, I just think that, that's a natural human response. I've got to save you from making the same mistake that I made.
Yes.
So I'll impose rules on you. And along with that is the sense that if you make this mistake, it's not forgivable. So, I mean, I think that's one of the things, is that we're not very good at forgiving, or forgiving ourselves even for mistakes we make. So therefore, I'm gonna save you from making that, because it's so hard to forgive yourself afterwards, and it's so hard to let God forgive you afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll just shore this up with a whole bunch of rules to protect you.
Mm-hmm. And one way of saying that is that in our experience, we try to balance the unconditional covenants with the if covenants. We try to find a way of keeping in some tension between both of those, because life would seem too what if we didn't have the if covenants that depend on our response. It would seem too gracious, too irresponsible. I mean, we're afraid that we'll be, our experience is that we'll be irresponsible.
Well, and sometimes the rules are just like gifts. I know I've looked at the Old Testament often as these rules that have come down is a gift of God, because sometimes you want to do what's right and you just don't know. So you sometimes are given great help by a rule that says, this sounds like the way that's best pleasing to God. So I don't look on rules and the law as necessarily being bad stuff. I think it is also a gift.
A gracious gift of God, and the people receive the law as beautiful, and there are psalms about your law is sweeter than honey to my lips, and so on and so on and so on.
Just when it gets overused, it becomes bad.
Well, David, we've got to be a bit spoiled and so forth, like, you know.
That's what Israel was afraid of.
He acts like a spoiled son at that time. And yet, generally a parent learns that every child tests what the limits are. And a child is lost unless there are some limits known to them.
The question
and
is whether
limits.
We can afford to have rulers who are children psychologically.
Well, mankind is not of the mind of God and so forth. They need some guidelines of some sort. If they were that smart, then they wouldn't have to tell them the Ten Commandments, would they? They would know that to begin with.
Any more in this general line of thought? This covenant, this unconditional covenant with David, became a touchstone for Israel to do some reflection on what are the responsibilities of leadership and how does leadership and the community interact. And their conclusion, as this covenant turns up modified in later versions, is that the king has got to live justly and rightly, or the king, the leadership, the government, doesn't deserve this kind of eternal blessing. But another strand of development of this idea of the unconditioned promise that God gave to the leadership turns into the idea that the Messiah will come. So this is where the origin of that sort of hope that somehow, someday, it will work out and there will be a leader worthy of this promise comes from. And David's own dynasty actually, well, if you want to remember a date for the Old Testament, King David is about 1000 BC. You can kind of keep that as a mental peg to hang a timeline on in your mind. King David, 1000 BC. And his descendants did continue on the throne of the southern part of the kingdom, which we call Judah, until about 587 BC. But after that, David's descendants were not literally on the throne. And so at that point, they said, and even in the time that it was people of David's bloodline, they still were having plenty of problems, and it was no great blessed, safe kingdom. And so something seemed to have gone wrong with this promise of God. And then they said, well, maybe righteousness of the king was part of it. Maybe that's what God meant, even if God didn't say it that way. So that was that line of reflection. But the other line of reflection was, well, you know, God made this promise unconditionally, and we expect God's going to do it. And if not right now with these literal blood descendants of David, maybe another king anointed one. You know, they didn't crown kings in those days. They poured oil over their head to invest them as kings. And at renewal ceremonies every year where they celebrated that this was their king, they would pour oil on their head. And in Hebrew, the word for anointing is the word the Messiah, the anointed one. And in Greek, that word is the Christ, the anointed one. So they started saying, well, you know, if it's not these literal descendants of David yet, then sometime somebody like David, the anointed one, the Messiah, the Christ, is going to come. So this covenant gave rise to this whole expectation that there would be a Messiah, that God would be in charge of history in such a way that sometime there would be a king who would live in righteousness and justice for all the people and establish such a community on earth. So you're saying, well, the covenant that we live in with God now is more like the unconditional covenant, in that no obligations are placed on us, but God offers us grace freely through David's descendant, Jesus Christ.
In this time that when David was getting this promise and this connection with God, does it talk about what the people's then response was to David and the commitment to David and the covenant to David?
What did the people have to do in response to David? You know, David doesn't seem to have been the problem. It seems like David was a good enough politician all along that people were generally supportive. They had some questions, but he would do things that won their admiration. It was Solomon who began to be the problem, because Solomon lived more removed from the people, didn't go out and fight with them, didn't show his generosity to the people, had bazillion people in his harem and in his court that were supported by the hard work of all of the other. I mean, Solomon started an empire. And so suddenly they were like the other nations and no longer this democratic league of people working together under the covenant.
It was under Solomon that actually the limits of to the Euphrates and so forth like that was attained.
Yeah.
And so, what do you think about our leaders today? You think, okay, Jimmy Carter professed to love God and serve God, and why didn't people, you know, why wasn't this a great government?
And that is along the line of a question I think it would be fun to discuss and push in light of David, and that is, what is the connection between leadership, people, God's will, God's promise? Especially maybe in the United States, where our founding thinkers said, well, we're going to be the new Israel, and we're going to live in that covenant. Is David's covenant living, God's covenant with David living among us in the public life that we share with one another, or just in the church? Or is it even in the church? You know, how do we experience this kind of gracious covenant of God? Where do we experience it in our life?
Well, Adam says of it, it isn't any one big thing, because we can all see too much sin in any of those things that you, any of those entities that you just named. So it has to be that it's still here and hope is still there, but it's glimpses of it we see, of people living with each other and living in love and sharing and caring and letting love be their motivation. And it does happen. I'm not that much of a pessimist. We do see it. But it's not a government and it's not the church. It's not a country.
What if all of David's followers were worried about you questioning authority?
What if all of David's followers were wearing a button that said question authority? What do you think?
I think that they would become Christian. I mean, I think they would become followers of David. If indeed he was following God, they would say, hey, this works, or it doesn't work. I don't know that. I'd like to hear what other people say.
In David's time, didn't God call people as a nation? whereas now they're called more so than they are now. And now it's more as an individual.
Maybe. How did they know that?
That some people use that were used to the God.
And so how is our situation different now? Is our situation different now?
It is. When Jesus came, he brought the individual out.
So you're saying since Jesus' time, it hasn't been a matter of nations, it's been a matter of individuals. Interesting. And that's kind of what we're going to move into tomorrow, if you're able to come back. The new covenant and the now covenant. We'll try to bring it up to date, maybe. But just to summarize, for me, the fascinating thing about this covenant that God made with David and the people, actually, with David and his descendants for the sake of the people of Israel. The fascinating thing about it is that it's not pure religion, it's politics. And so somehow God's will for us and the place that God works out God's will for us is in our public life together. And this can be a blessing insofar as it reminds us that religion is not just a privatized thing, but it does have everything to do with how we live in community. Small communities, large communities, global communities. That's the positive side of it. The danger side of it is that this promise of God can be turned into an ideology that justifies a very ungodly, unrighteous way of leadership and life and governance. And it's always a judgment call as to if you're living in faith or using faith to support an idol. And there's no pure religion off somewhere else. There's no way not to be involved with these thorny questions of life together in light of our covenant with God.
When you come into the area of conditions and requirements and all, we've talked about explicit ones that are in the text, but many times in guarantees or various things like that, there are implied conditions and all.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the things in terms of that God expected some performance on the part of people. Mm-hmm. You could look at that. Some things as being implied, which may not specifically be stated.
Maybe. But on the other hand, if we say we're justified by grace through faith, then we're saying God takes us the way we are and is willing to work with us.
Yeah, but if our faith doesn't show in our actions, then it becomes questionable.
Yeah.
Whether we really
That's the voice of the Epistle of James speaking, isn't it, right there? Yeah, good. We're at the end of time, so thank you very much for this hour.